I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today for Give Me 5-126, Introduction of Federal Acquisition Regulations. Today, Barbara English will give us an overview on what your responsibilities will be based on the Federal Acquisitions Regulations clauses in your contract. This course offers a detailed but common sense explanation of what the clauses mean. My name is Scott Nolan, Give Me 5 Program Coordinator for Women Impacting Public Policy. Before we begin, I do have a few housekeeping items. We're recording this presentation, including the question and answer segment. I'll make the podcast and the training materials available on the Give Me 5 website. We like to keep these sessions interactive, and we invite your questions as the session is delivered, but we've muted the lines for audio quality. During the presentation, if you have any questions for our instructor, please feel free to send your questions immediately via the chat function that's on the right-hand side of the webinar. It says Public Chat at the top. Lastly, your feedback is very important to us. Please take a moment to share your thoughts on the Give Me 5 feedback survey that will be in your inbox, along with the links to the podcast and this presentation after the training. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce our course instructor, Barbara English. Barbara is president of English Solutions Incorporated, where she consults with and provides effective marketing strategies to small businesses to optimize their ability to win contracts with federal agencies and assist very experienced small business with the knowledge, understanding, and insight necessary to be more competitive in the government contracting arena. She's also the director of the Procurement Technical Assistance Center in Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce and director of small business programs at Defense Contract Management Agency headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. Barbara honed her 36 years meritorious federal contracting career with the Department of Defense, being handpicked as a principal procurement advisor to a two-star general on procurement issues and managing the most complex defense federal acquisitions regulations on behalf of the Office of Secretary of Defense. She chairs Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce, Athena Board of Directors for a fast-track small business client, serves as panel member on Small Business Administration's E200 Executive Training for Small Business Owners in Jacksonville, and serves as board member on Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce Entrepreneurial Small Business Division. In June 2011, she was named Top 50 Small Business Influencers in Jacksonville, Florida by Small Business Advantage magazine. So without any further ado, Barbara, the floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It is indeed a pleasure to have you on this presentation. I am just absolutely thrilled to talk to you about the Federal Acquisition Regulation. And so with that, let me share what it is I'd like to see us accomplish today. And what we want to do is talk about the Federal Acquisition Regulation structure, just how is this huge document structured. I want to talk about some FAR conventions, and then we'll talk about the actual FAR clauses themselves, and then I would be happy to entertain questions, and I might tell you now, feel free, as I'm going through the presentation, to ask me questions on the public chat. I'd be happy to answer them as we go. In fact, I encourage you to do that, so feel free. Okay. Exactly where is this document? Where is the Federal Acquisition Regulation? Well, if you were to Google that, you could actually find it in a number of places. But I will tell you that the presentation, the FAR, is 1,981 pages. So it's definitely not something you want to find on Google and then print. And in addition to that, at least once a quarter, a number of those pages are revised and updated. So you always want to be able to find the latest version of anything you're looking for in the FAR. So the best place to find the latest version of the FAR is at Acquisition Central at www.acquisition.gov. So once you're there, you then want to click on Federal Acquisition Regulation. And let me just take a moment to tell you that on acquisition.gov, there is a wealth of information. So I would ask you to actually spend some time looking at a number of the links there. Today we're going to focus on the FAR only, but I encourage you to peruse that website a little bit more at your leisure. Okay, so once you're there and you've clicked into the FAR, I want you to go to the Find box when you click into the FAR. And this is very, very important because you want to be able to get to what you're looking for very, very quickly. So, for example, if you're looking for something relative to cost and pricing data, you can literally put in the words cost and pricing data and then click Find, and it will take you to every reference in the FAR that has that. But if you just happen to know exactly what it is you're looking for in the FAR, for example, a clause number 52-213-3, if you put that number in and then click Find, it will take you to that exact page. So as you are perusing the FAR and using it, you want to get very, very familiar with that Find box. It just helps you navigate through those almost 2,000 pages relatively easily. Okay, now let's get familiar with how the FAR is structured. As you can see, it is structured in subchapters as well as in parts. And what I've done for you today is to highlight the parts that I recommend you start getting very, very familiar with. As a small business owner, I would say that you probably would not want to take on almost 2,000 pages at one time. So what I'm highlighting for you are what I consider to be the critical areas in the FAR that you want to take a look at as your first priority. The first one is part two, where it talks about definitions of words and terms. And I'm sure in any conversations you might be having with government officials, you'll hear a lot of terms that you may not have heard before. You may even hear some acronyms and wonder what they are. This is the section to go to that whenever you're in a federal government contracting arena or in any conversation and someone is saying terms to you that you don't fully understand, you want to go to part two and you will likely see what those terms and words mean. So part two is particularly important for that. Part nine is also an important area. Because if you are interested in winning any government contract, you want to know in advance how the federal government treats a contractor's qualifications for a contract. And so Section 9 talks to that. Moving to the next page, we are now looking at simplified acquisition procedures. Part 13 deals with if you are awarded a contract within the simplified acquisition procedures, which is $150,000 or less, your contract is going to be structured in accordance with this part. So for that reason, you want to know what those requirements would be. You go to Part 13. In addition to that, in Part 15, sometimes the federal government awards a contract by negotiation. And if that contract is awarded by negotiation, this particular part tells you how that process works. The opposite of contracting by negotiation, just for your information, would be, say, contracting by sealed bids, where there is no negotiation. You simply submit your price, and then the contract is awarded based on price only. That would be the opposite of contract by negotiation. And then an area that I think is probably as critical as part two, understanding the terms and the words, is part 19, particularly if you are a small business owner. You want to know what the federal government small business programs are, and all of them are described and explained in great detail in Part 19. So of all the parts that we've talked about so far, I would make Part 2, number 1, and probably part 19, number 2, and then I would go back to the other parts that we talked about. And in addition to the small business programs, the federal government also has socioeconomic programs that are described in part 26. You would think that with these 26 parts we're done, but we're only halfway. There are more parts. Part 32 is a part that you would want to look at if you want to find out how the government pays on contracts. Do they pay in advance? Do they pay by progress? Do they pay after the contract is awarded? Everything related to contract financing is in that particular part. Okay, and continuing on, then let's look at part 44 would be one that I highly recommend to you because you may be in the position of being a subcontractor to a prime contractor being awarded a contract, or you could be a prime contractor and do subcontracting to other businesses. In either case, you want to know what the federal government's policies and procedures are relative to that. Okay, and then let's go to part 52. I want to kind of highlight what that is. So from part 1 to part 51, it kind of lays out what the policies and the procedures are. And to some degree, it's also guidance and direction to the contracting officer who's awarding the contract as to what they should put in any contract that they award. Part 52 is for the contractor being awarded the contract. So part 52 is where the federal government levies all of its requirements on a contractor that results from the other 51 parts. So you always want to look at part 52 to see what federal government requirements have been levied on your contract. You may from time to time hear someone talking about a government form like a standard form 1442 or DD form 611. If anyone ever talks to you about federal government forms associated with federal government contracting, part 53 has a copy of all those forms, instructions for all of those forms, and their use. So part 53 is where you would go to. Now, for anyone who has not seen a federal government contract with FAR clauses in it, you can simply go to fbo.gov and pull up any solicitation that happens to be open for bid, and you'll be able to open that document and you'll see in the solicitation itself what the Part 52 clauses are. So I would encourage you to go to fbo.gov and pull up a solicitation to actually see in real life what a resulting solicitation and contract would be for any particular product or service that would interest you. Okay, that's the structure of the FAR. So from there, we're going to go to what are some of the standard conventions that you see in the FAR that determine the requirements that are there. And before I talk to that, I did want to mention that I had the honor of being responsible for the pre-award sections of the Federal Acquisition Regulation for 5 years when I worked at the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the Pentagon. And if I recall, it was roughly about 26 of those 51 parts that we just mentioned. I had the responsibility for writing and revising those regulations for the entire federal government to follow. And I can tell you I truly enjoyed my 5 years of doing that. Let's talk FAR convention for a moment. The way that the FAR regulations are structured and the requirements are levied is sometimes by the acquisition threshold. For example, if the federal government wanted to award a $3,000 contract, it would be called a micro purchase, and there would be certain federal government requirements just associated with that $3,000 threshold. On the complete opposite spectrum, if it was a $5 million contract, then there would be a whole lot of additional federal government requirements imposed in your contract. So what I'm really saying to you is, depending upon the dollar value of the contract, there are certain federal government requirements that are levied. And so let me go through what some of those acquisition thresholds are. The first one was micro-purchase. That is the simplest form of a federal government contract, and the federal government typically likes to use a credit card for that. And I might add that the federal government can award a $3,000 contract or less via a credit card sole source. It really doesn't have to be competed at all. That might be a little tidbit that you might not know, so thought I'd share that with you. The next threshold is a simplified acquisition threshold, and that's for contracts valued at $150,000 or less. And then above that is what I call a regular contract. So anything above $150,000 is considered to be a regular government contract. And then when you reach the threshold of $650,000 or more, the government imposes additional requirements, and those are normally associated with cost and pricing data and certifying that your data is accurate, complete, and timely. And then the last threshold is $5 million that I mentioned earlier. If your contract is over $5 million, the government levies additional requirements, and most of those are associated with the code of conduct and business ethics. So one way to think about the requirements in the FAR are based on the dollar value of the contract. Another way is by the type of contract itself. Sometimes a contract is fixed price, sometimes it's based on cost. And so if it's fixed price, certain requirements are levied. If it's a cost-type contract, certain requirements are levied. Likewise, sometimes you may get a purchase order, you may get a contract, or you may get a delivery order. So that's also a different way to think of the contracts, okay? Now, I have no questions yet, and I am so looking for questions, and I'm hoping I've piqued some kind of interest at this point. So if you've got any thoughts or comments or questions, feel free to tell me about it in the chat. Okay, so now I want to talk about the convention of how the FAR clauses are structured. It is very important to know that, and you remember already that the FAR clauses themselves is in that the last section of the FAR, Part 52, is where all the FAR clauses are. Sometimes the government has exceptions to the rule. So you kind of want to read, if you go to a FAR clause, you will see that it says this applies to this situation, except it doesn't apply in this situation. So you'll find a lot of times that the FAR clauses have exceptions to the rules. The other convention with respect to FAR clauses is a lot of times they will be incorporated by reference, meaning it will have the number of the clause and the title of the clause, but the text of the clause is not there at all, which means you would need to go back to acquisition.gov and literally find the clause that's in your contract that has been incorporated by reference. Under no circumstances would you want to sign off on a contract with the federal government for clauses that are incorporated by reference and you have not gone back to see what those requirements are for your particular contract. Okay, so we now have the structure of the FAR, and we have conventions relative to the FAR. What I'd like to do for the remainder of our time is to actually highlight some of those clauses that you want to pay particular attention to if you are in the process of being awarded a contract, or you feel you'll be awarded a contract sometime in the very near future. And I kind of want to give you all a live example of something. Actually, this morning for 2 hours, I had a client who was awarded a contract. They've actually had the contract award for 2 weeks. And they asked me to come in to please clarify for them what the requirements were under a number of these contract clauses. And it was 93 clauses that were in their contract. And I'll tell you the dollar value of that was only $90,000. So on a $90,000 job, the government had imposed 90-plus clauses, very similar to the ones that I'm going to be going over with you today. I will tell you, though, that my client felt a little bit of pressure because the contract is already 2 weeks old, and there are requirements that say you have to provide certain information to the government within 30 days, certain information within 7 days, and even certain information within 14 days relative to some of these contracts. So they were feeling a little bit under the behind the eight ball on getting themselves familiar with these requirements after a contract was awarded. Okay, I have a couple of questions. And one of the questions was, does the FAR say anything about response time after submitting an RFQ? No, it does not. That is solely the contracting officer's discretion as to the response time. And that's typically when you see an RFQ at FBO.gov, it will have a response time laid out there for you. So the FAR itself does not address that. The second question I have is, how does the FAR apply to GSA MOBIS with regard to small business set aside? GSA schedule is one of those FAR parts, and so you might want to go there and look at it. I'm trying to get the gist of your question, though. How does the FAR apply with respect to small business set-asides? I will tell you that when you're on the GSA schedule or the MOBIS schedule, and for those of you who aren't familiar with MOBIS, MOBIS is the professional services schedule under GSA, and GSA is General Services Administration. When the FAR says that a GSA / MOBIS schedule can be awarded to a small or a large business, irrespective of small business set-aside. So there are no real small business set-aside requirements under a GSA schedule. Hope that answers your question. The next question, after sending in a bid, when should you hear back from the contracting officer? It really does depend on the dollar value. If it's a simplified acquisition, that could be a matter of a couple weeks. If it's a $1 million one, it could be more like 60 to 90 days. If it's $5 million or higher, it could be almost 6 months. So it really does depend on the requirement. Pamela says, I've heard that mobile schedule buys cannot be set aside. That is absolutely true. Pamela. Now, there are some ways that even though it's not a small business set-aside, if a small business wins the award, the contracting officer can take credit, though, for it being small business. Okay. Now, what I want to do with you at this moment is to tell you the typical clauses that you're going to see in a contract that is less than $650,000. That will cover the majority of clauses that a small business might get on their first couple of awards from the federal government. So I've chosen $650,000 just to be sure that I give you good coverage on a contract that you might likely get if you've been doing business with the federal government or if you're new and you're jumping into it for the first few years with the federal government. Now, if you may recall, the $650,000 threshold, when it's above that, more clauses are added in terms of requirements. So let's go through some of these. I promise you I will not go through each and every one of these. I will just highlight for you some of the federal government requirements that will be on your contracts. The first one I want to talk about, and by the way, let me give you a convention. If you recall, there are 53 parts to the FAR, and the clauses themselves follow the parts, okay? So you may recall that part two was definitions. Here is the two, okay? So that's how you can keep up with the parts. So the definitions that are applicable to your contract, if you have this clause, will be right here, all right? This part three was called improper business practices. So these are some of the clauses that would be incorporated in your contract with respect to improper business practices. What I want to tell you about this gratuities clause is this. The federal government employees, contracting officers, cannot accept gifts or entertainment from contractors. If they were to accept them or if you were to provide them, the contract could be terminated for default. So this is one of those big deal clauses that you want to read from beginning to end and be sure that you understand all the nuances associated with it. It is not an absolute rule like that. For example, if you want to give them something that's a nominal value, $10 or less, that's okay. But if it's over the threshold in the gratuities clause, then you can't do it. My advice, and I was a contracting officer for almost 30 years, my rule with respect to this was I accepted no gratuities, period. Even if I could accept a $10 gratuity from a contractor, I just did not accept them, period. So that's the way that I chose to be sure that I was in compliance with this clause. You might want to adopt that similar thing, that you just don't give any gratuities to any government official at all relative to discussions about contracting opportunities with the federal government. So that's one of those must clauses you want to read for sure. Okay, I have a question. Where exactly in the FAR does it speak to contracting officers doing an open bid before a solicitation closes? Not sure I understand that. I can tell you what the rule is, though, and your question is very appropriate because we're talking about improper business practices at the moment. Contracting officers do not talk to contractors that have submitted a bid until after the bid has closed, or if the contractors that have submitted a bid are considered to be in the competitive range, meaning they have a reasonable chance of getting the award, and discussions are held. So the general rule is that contracting officers do not speak to contractors once a solicitation has opened. Hope that answers your question. All right. Let's see what we want to talk about here. This sort of covers what we just talked about. If for some reason you were to be involved in any illegal or improper activity relative to Part 3 of the FAR, your contract would be canceled or rescinded, and then you would be liable for any recovery of funds associated with that in addition to a penalty. So this is just not an area where you want to find yourself in. Okay, if you're following my FAR convention, you're noticing now I'm going to Part 4 of the FAR and many FAR requirements that may be levied in your contract. I will tell you that if you are performing any work on a military base, this clause deals with any requirements associated with working on a military base and whether or not those requirements themselves, that is your actual contract, whether it's confidential, secret, or top secret, this particular clause addresses what your requirements would be for that. And in essence, it talks to the National Industrial Security Operations Manual and all of the requirements associated with security relative to the statement of work that you're performing on, the product you're providing, or literally being on the military base providing that service, or a federal government activity, not just necessarily a military base. I'm a little biased. My whole federal government career was with the Department of Defense, but it applies to everything federal. Okay. So the next part. I have a question. Is there anything in the FAR that allows for due diligence for non-incumbent visitors doing, vendors doing a recompete for a contract? Not really. Let me repeat the question. Is there anything in the FAR that allows for due diligence for non-competitive vendors doing a recompete on a contract? The thing that you'd want to look for on a recompete is the evaluation criteria and how the contracting officer is going to determine who the awardee should be. So the due diligence would be on your part to be sure that the evaluation criteria, that you literally can get the maximum points relative to the way that the government is saying that they're going to evaluate the proposal and who would be the one to win. Okay, we're still in part four with respect to personal identity and birth case of contractor personnel. I don't know if there's anybody on the line who's had to renew their driver's license recently. If you have, you will find that the requirements for getting a driver's license now and the identification requirements are just incredibly different than they were 3 or 4 years ago. The same applies with respect to federal government contracts. The federal government does want to know the personal identity of the contractor personnel that you're dealing with respect to, also with respect to their subcontractor personnel. And so if you're interested in what those requirements are, they're laid out in this clause 204-9. Okay, we're moving to another part. This is part 9. And part 9 deals with contractors' qualifications to receive an award. And this clause basically says, when you are awarded a contract, you have to certify that you are not debarred from receiving a federal government contract, that your business has no tax delinquencies, and that the principals in the contractor's office have no civil or criminal indictments or convictions within the last 3 years. So you are certifying that none of those things have occurred. That's what that certificate is about. And then 209-6 pretty much imposes the same requirements on any subcontractors that you might be using under a federal government contract, if in fact the subcontract that you are awarding to that particular subcontractor is in excess of $30,000. I have a question. Where in the FAR does it discuss having a solicitation sole sourced? That, I would literally have to flip back through the sections to tell you where that is, but it is definitely covered. And so let me just take a minute and tell you where it is. It's under subpart B, subpart B, part 6. We would discuss sole source contracting. Okay. Let's move to next area. All right, part 15, you see the 215 there. This is the part about when a contract is negotiated. And if your contract happens to be a cost reimbursable type contract, the federal government will want to audit your records And they're also asking you to maintain your records in a certain way. So this particular clause applies when you have a cost reimbursement contract and they're telling you the way that you need to account for your costs, if the government's going to be paying for all of your costs on that particular contract, that is reasonable, allowable, and allocable. Okay, let's go to the next section. I like you all's questions. Thank you very much. All right, now, I want somebody to tell me on public chat what's the name of this section. What does 219 deal with? Everybody should know that because I labeled that as the number two section you all ought to read. It's the small business section. And so I just want to go through a couple of clauses relative to how the government treats small business concerns. This particular clause about HUB zone, and HUB zone stands for Historically Underutilized Business Zone, the federal government, if you happen to be a HUB zone contract, a HUB zone certified small business, and you are bidding on a requirement, and you are bidding against another concern that is not HUB zone, you get a 10% price preference when your price is evaluated. And so if both companies bid $100,000 and one is HUB zone and one is not, yours is evaluated as $90,000 and you would win the award. That's what this clause talks about. Okay? This next clause, utilization of small business concerns, talks to the government's policy that it likes to use small businesses to the maximum practicable in prime and subcontracts and wants you to do the same. Okay. Pamela asked, even if it is not a HUB zone set aside, and that is correct, Pamela, even if it's not a HUB zone set aside, that evaluation, price evaluation applies. Okay, now I am switching horses on you completely. Up until this point, I've been talking about all contract clauses if the contract value is $650,000 or less. This time I want to talk about if the contract is above $650,000, and what would be some of the small business requirements levied on a contract if it's over $650,000. Okay, let me first tell you that these clauses, subcontracting plan requirements, do not apply if you are a small business. So if you're a small business and you were awarded a contract for $700,000, these clauses would not apply to you. However, if you are a large business and your contract is over $650,000, they would apply. Now, the reason I want to spend some time with you today talking about that is because if you are a small business, this clause requires that large businesses, as a result of getting a federal government contract, provide as a part of their contract their plan for subcontracting to small businesses. And there may be a number of you on the phone who may have been approached by a large business saying, hey, I've got a 5% women-owned goal on my contract, subcontracting goal on my contract, and I need to use women-owned businesses to fulfill my subcontracting requirements in my prime contract. This is the clause that activates all of that. Likewise, if for some reason a large business does not live up to the subcontracting plan that's a result of their contract, liquidated damages can be imposed on that large business for failure to meet its subcontract plan requirements. I will tell you, though, that the test for that is a tough test. The test says they have to not have made a good faith effort. So the government would have to prove how they didn't even try at all. And if they didn't even try at all, then you can't impose liquidated damages. But if they made good faith, then liquidated damages would not apply. So that's a hard test. I would say, for the government to prove. Very few contracts. It is done, but it is not done a lot, liquidated damages. You will see this clause more prevalent in construction contracts, and probably this particular liquidated damages clause is invoked, and literally liquidated damages are imposed on a contract a lot more in construction contracts than any other. Okay? Moving on, and I see we have about 15 minutes left, and we're doing really good with respect to time. All right, we're moving to Part 22, and Part 22 deals with equal opportunity. And in essence, all of these clauses pretty much requires that you, as a federal government contractor, are using equal opportunity in terms of the folks that you are employing when using a federal government contract. And these are more clauses relative to that. If you are awarded a service contract, the federal government will tell you for your non-professional labor that you use on a services contract that you have to follow minimum wage requirements in accordance with the Service Contract Act of 1965. So this is a definite clause you want to take a look at to be sure you are in compliance with respect to the labor rates that you are using for the folks that you have employed with you relative to your government contract. Fair labor standards, again, everything related to equal opportunity on a federal government contract. Okay, moving now to Part 23 and any clauses related to that. This one, relative to drug-free workplace, is one that catches a lot of small businesses by surprise. The federal government requires, and by the way, this isn't a $90,000 contract. So this is one of those clauses that if it's over $25,000, it applies. So you're going to see this in almost every government contract. The federal government requires that any contractor receiving a contract have a drug-free workplace program in effect. So this is not one of those where you want to put it in place once your contract's awarded. You kind of want to know in advance that that's a requirement. And for anybody that's close to getting a federal government contract or wants information about a program that they need to put in place, there happens to be a contractor here in Jacksonville, Florida, and I suspect there's others around the country that for free will help you put your drug-free workplace program in place. So take a look at that clause. It's not particularly onerous, I don't think, but it does require you to do certain things with respect to our program. If you're interested in getting some help on that free from this particular contractor here, and I must tell you that they only serve the Jacksonville, Florida region. So if you're from California, I'm not so sure they can help you, but they might be able to refer you to a like company that has that. This particular company here in Jacksonville received a grant from the state. I'm not even sure that it came from the federal government to provide assistance to small businesses. So I would ask you to definitely take advantage of that. And 227 deals with authorization and consent with respect to whether or not you can award particular contracts to subcontractors. And then, of course, 227-2 deals with if you are delivering a product and you want it patented, what are some of the notices and assistances relative to that. Okay. Let's see, I have another question. If a small business teams with a hub zone business, does a 10% discount apply? It would only apply if the hub zone contractor is the one signing the solicitation and the offer to the government. So only in that case would it apply. Okay, back to part 29 and 32. I think these categories are fairly self-explanatory with respect to taxes and interest and those kinds of things. And then, if you ever get in a dispute with the federal government over a particular requirement in a government contract, this clause tells you how you deal with that. It talks about the requirements relative to protesting after award, and if for some reason you had to file bankruptcy, the requirements relative to that. All right? This particular clause is important. If you have a fixed price contract and somehow the contract changed, meaning you wanted to change how you wanted to perform the contract and deliver the product or service, or if the government changed their minds about it, this clause tells you how that would be handled. If you're delivering a product and the government is providing property to you to build that product, this clause talks about how to handle government property in your possession while you're building, whatever it is you're building. Okay? All of these are very important clauses. If for some reason the government needs to terminate your contract for convenience, this clause talks about what you are entitled to if the government terminates. And hopefully you know the government can terminate for convenience for almost any cause. Right in the middle of your contract. You could be 10 days into it or 90% done. The government could terminate at any time. However, when they do terminate for convenience, you are entitled to equitable adjustments. And so that clause talks about how you would be reimbursed for that. Okay? And then if it's a cost-type contract, it talks to that. In addition to termination for convenience, the government can also terminate for default. And when it says default, that means the contractor defaulted on the contract. And this particular clause deals with termination for default and how to handle that. Okay? I'm down to a couple of pages. I mentioned to you earlier that in your contract sometimes you're going to see clauses incorporated by reference. This will be the section in your contract where they would be called out simply by the number and title of the clause, and then you would need to go back to acquisition.gov to find those particular clauses, okay? That is my introduction to you of the FAR. With 10 minutes to spare. Does anyone have any questions about any of that they want to talk about? Any questions at all? If so, let me know in public chat. I hope this was helpful to you in terms of giving you at least some ideas about if you were awarded a government contract, what some of those requirements would be. So I hope that's been helpful to you. And with that, Scott, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. I will leave it open for just another minute or two to see if anybody has any questions. So I encourage you to put them in the public chat if you have them. And there we go.
Okay. There's actually a section called Market Research. The question was, what section? I think you all are testing me to see if I still remember all 53 parts. And I'm going to tell you that I don't, so I'm actually cheating. It's part 10. Part 10 deals with market research. What important points should a small business know about market research? This is one of my favorites. What I think is most important for a small business with respect to market research is before you even approach a federal government activity, or before you even bid on anything that you see in FBO.gov, you ought to do market research to see how much the federal government has bought what you're looking for, looking to sell to them previously. And there's an excellent place to find that. It's called the Federal Procurement Data System. And the website for that is the exact title that I just gave you, F as in federal, P as in procurement, D as in data, S as in system, .gov. So FPDS.gov is a great place to do market research. When you go there, you can see whether or not this is a new contract for the first time, or if the government has bought this same product or service for the last 15 years. FPDS.gov is a repository for all of the government contracts that have been awarded further back in 2003. So if you go to that website, you can literally put in the name of the agency that you're getting ready to submit your bid on, and you can find all kinds of information. I am a big fan of the Federal Procurement Data System and the market research that you can get out of there. So I'll just give you this one little piece of information. If I were a small business, I would really be looking to how can you somehow put yourself in a sole source situation so the government is only dealing with you and no one else. And that's another whole topic. And I will tell you that I do talk to I've done webinars before on with Give Me Five on the top five strategies to really win government contracts, and I'm sure in the next couple of months I'll be giving that presentation again. However, Scott, they can find that in your repository. Is that correct?
This is true. And if anyone cannot find that information, then just email me and I can send it to you. And my email address is snolen@whip.org, and my email address will come with the links to the presentation and the recordings that everyone will receive tomorrow. We do have one last question here from Pamela. She says, do you know how often it is updated with regard to contract information?
Yes, it is updated every day. Every contract that's awarded appears there the next day it's awarded. So it's very, very real data. That's an excellent question. And if for some reason there's anybody who wants to ask me any further questions, feel free to email me too. And you see my email address there. I'd be happy to answer any further questions. And thank you all so very much.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for your absolutely outstanding presentation. And thank you, everybody on the line, for joining us today and participating on this call. I hope everyone found all this information helpful. A podcast and the presentation of this training will be sent out this week to all participants on today's call. We have an ongoing calendar of events and webinars, so please look at giveme5.com to register for upcoming training sessions. Join us Wednesday, August 17th for Give Me 5102, What's Next After I Register for the CCR with Gloria Laverne Larkin, President Joint Logistics Manager Incorporated. I'm sorry, Gloria Laverne Jackson. Women Impacting Public Policy is the voice for women in business in our nation's capital, advocating for and on behalf of women and minorities in business and the legislative process for our nation, creating economic opportunities and building bridges and alliances to other small business organizations. WIP and American Express Open are dedicated to opening federal procurement opportunities for women business owners everywhere. Thank you very much and have a good day.